That was from actually. You know what that was from, Martin? That was from my my audio hijack. I hadn't paid for that version. I paid for the NiceCast, and that's why that was coming in. So NiceCast should be going cleanly, and we shouldn't have that problem. Now pulling in audio is kind of a nightmare because I'm purely on NiceCast because the audio hijack's not working for me. So when I try and pull in anything besides Skype, it doesn't work. So what I'm going to try and do, and I don't know how this will work, is I'm going to try and simply play it through my speakers. But I don't really think.
Okay.
I don't know how that well that will work. So let me try. So here we go. And I was, you know, Downs has been working on this all week diligently, getting it all set. And like an idiot, I come at it and just, maybe it'll work. And as usual, it doesn't. Can you hear that, Martin?
I can, yeah.
Can you count, suckers? I say the future is ours. If you can count... Now look what we have here before us. We've got the Saracens sitting next to the Jones Street Boys. We've got the Moon Runners right by the Van Cortlandt Rangers. Nobody is wasting nobody. That is a miracle. And miracles is the way things ought to be. You're standing right now with 9 delegates from 100 gangs. And there's over 100 more. That's 20,000 hardcore members. 40,000 counting affiliates. And 20,000 more not organized, but ready to fight. 60,000 soldiers. Now, there ain't but 20,000 police in the whole town. Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Now, here's the sum total. One gang could run this city. One gang. Nothing would move without us allowing it to happen. We could tax the crime syndicates, the police, because we got the streets, suckers. Can you dig it?
And this whole idea... This whole idea, Martin, of them having the streets and...
That's right.
60,000. I love it when he does the math.
Street math.
Love it, right? Like, there's only 20,000 cops. There's 60,000 of us. And what's more, he's talking about a kind of idealistic revolution in the streets, a civil war in New York City based on gangs.
That's right. It's great. It's kind of a street Martin Luther King, isn't it? It's a very inspiring opening, and kind of and where it goes from there is very unexpected then as well, because you think it's going to be about that story, and of course it kind of goes off on a completely different angle because he gets assassinated at that point. So it's.
And wouldn't you like to see the film? I'd love to see the film made that Cyrus is trying to see, right? Like,
yeah, that would be cool, wouldn't it? Yeah.
I mean, and the thing is I've always, I don't think it's people have talked about this again and again with this film. I mean, he is very much a Martin Luther King figure. I mean, yeah. This idea of bringing them together, although he's not very nonviolent, right? He's going to run the city. And, you know, Frederick Jameson, who's the film critic, talked a lot about this film and about a lot of 80s and late 70s New York City films, particularly as these kind of like subtle revolution films packed up as pop culture. And obviously the revolution goes totally wrong. But just like what we're talking about with that, like, I would have loved to see the other movie that could have been made when they organize and they start kicking some ass, right?
Because you think, you know, he thinks when he's doing that math, as do Americans, like, so you do the math. It's kind of, it's their turn almost. Like, other people, the unions have run the city, you know, the cops have run the city, the big businesses have run the city. So why not let us have a go, you know? And so that would be a very cool film to see, wouldn't it? But you know, it'd turn out that all end up being just as corrupt or whatever, you know, absolute power corrupts kind of thing, and they'd end up being exactly the same. But
yeah, you see some of that in the film itself. Like when another thing that kind of allured me to this film, especially when we're talking about DS-106 Radio, is, I mean, the way in which the '70s, this film, and there's a few films from the '70s that do it well, the way this film uses radio. And the DJ,
yeah,
you know how she comes on.
Yes,
you know, it's awesome.
And you only ever see her lips, don't you? Right up against the mic,
that's
really cool.
Right. It is really, really cool. And like you see her there, and she's like, "Hey, warriors, you made it this far, but you're not going to make it any further, right? Like, we've got you owned." And it's another thing that comes out of that is the Grand Mercy Riffs.
Yeah,
the Grand Mercy Riffs are that group that basically, you know, are coming. Are that the organized, they're the badass, they're the, you know, the most badass gang in New York City. And they're the ones with the sunglasses, and they're lined up very militarily, like the Black Panthers or what you would say is that real vision. And they're the ones who are actually, you know, control the airwaves. You know?
And it was I think Public Enemy took on a lot of that look with their what was the kind of the gang that Public Enemy used to have on stage with them that were led by Professor Farrakhan, whatever. They had that kind of real riffs look about them as well.
Yeah, there's a
couple of lines in the boy. There's one. I love the scene with the orphans. They're kind of they're a great kind of little urchin street gang that they kind of come across. But also love the scene when they get back home. He says, and they see the Ferris wheel. Is it of New Jersey? He says, no, whenever we see that wheel, we figure we're home.
That's right.
That line always comes to my mind when I'm coming home to Cardiff and I have to come across the bridge on the M4. Whenever I see that bridge, I figure I'm home now.
That's right. And that's that classic Wonder Wheel in Coney Island. And what's interesting is they're on the other side, right? When they hear that big discussion or the speech by Cyrus, they're actually in the Bronx by Van Cortlandt Park. So, like, really, it is kind of like, it's interesting if you think about it in terms of New York City. It's like, it really does seem like another part of the world because of how much shit is going on between their 8 million people or whatever. And just, I mean, and the other thing about that film that I think is crazy is the way in which it, you know, views the city. You know, we've talked about this again and again on the blogs, like the way in which the city is seen as this kind of run down, horrific space. You know, the gangs are running the city. You know, there's a subway fights. You know, there's the Furies who come out with the baseball bats and attack them. You know, it's just the way that film captures the city and just looking at the subway with all the graffiti. It's just a totally different world, it seems like.
And I think there was a whole sort of raft of films that kind of really showed cities as like a place to be feared in a way, and that there was a kind of subculture and you could accidentally get caught up in it. And I think it was a kind of thing that they played a lot on the kind of fears of people living in suburbia. And I was growing up sort of just outside London at the time. I think it kind of really played on me. When you go into London, it's like it's another world and something really dangerous could happen to you. You know, it's like they didn't portray cities as a place where kind of real people lived. It was like everyone was part of a violent gang, you know, and this whole kind of 80s quite unrealistic view of, like, you know, what street punks were like and things. And
yeah,
that you could there's probably a really good PhD I think there in 80s portrayal of cities kind of demonstrated about our view of particularly the underclass or whatever, or the poor, but, you know, inner city life.
Yeah, and the way in which that kind of came after the whole move, and we talked about this before, but the move to the suburbs, like, you know, that, like, I as well grew up outside New York City, about 20 minutes, 30 minutes outside in a small suburban town called Baldwin, Long Island. And, you know, we had a 30-minute Long Island Railroad train in, but the idea of going into the city in the 70s and 80s was really a kind of horrific prospect often. Yeah. And the VHS culture, like we're talking about, kind of fueled that to no end. I mean, whether it be this or Chud. I mean, Chud is another favorite one of mine, where it's basically like there are monsters underground coming.
That's right. Coming to get you. Don't look down. So, and I think it was Bonfire of the Vanities kind of led up to that. It was kind of very much like the rich bloke going into the poor neighbourhood and getting caught up in a kind of nightmare for himself. But there are a lot of kind of films that led up to that, I think, and tried to sort of portray that paranoia about, you know, you don't understand this world. And I think in some ways that to make the kind of educational point, which I'll always try and do, it's like, I think I wonder if there's a similar kind of fear about the kind of the wild west of like of being out on the web, you know, compared to like the ivory towers of universities. It's, you know, it's like once you go out there, things are out of your control and anything can happen. You know, it's like, and I think there was a similar kind of paranoia and fear that they portrayed in those films.
That comes home to the web. I like that a lot, the way we're even thinking about the stuff we're doing. And when you talk about the Wild West, one that immediately comes to mind and has maybe one of the most memorable scenes for me of my whole childhood is Fort Apache, the Bronx, with Paul Newman. Now, what scene am I thinking about? You have any idea? This scene is crazy. So the scene I'm thinking about, and it's basically a guy who's on the Cross Bronx Expressway. His car breaks down. He gets off the Cross Bronx Expressway. And what happens is he goes and he meets a prostitute. And, you know, obviously prostitutes are all over, right, when it comes to the Bronx and that whole idea of, like, every corner there's a prostitute. Or whatever, he meets with a prostitute, and the prostitute who he's about to kind of consummate with actually has a razor blade in her mouth. And as he's ready to kind of, you know, kiss her or engage with her romantically, she kind of spins out the razor blade on her tongue, bites it in her teeth, and cuts his face open. And I just can't imagine a more kind of brutal vision. And it's apparent that he's not from the South Bronx. He's actually coming through the Cross Bronx Expressway. He's either maybe from Westchester County or from Long Island or from some other area, but he's this interloper. And then there's a really strange history there about the whole idea of the Cross Bronx Expressway and how that cut up that whole neighborhood. And there's a lot of history there behind the kind of pop notion of a particular area of New York, like, say, the South Bronx, which, you know, since the building of the Cross Bronx Expressway was once a great community and had become a kind of disenfranchised, if not one of the most unlivable places in North America. So, Martin, are you there? Man, I should not be running a radio show because I hear you. I know you're with me on Skype, but let me just see. Martin, are you there? Martin? Okay, well, I'm going to try and get Martin back on the line. But in the meantime, let me just play you a little commercial we've been working on. So enjoy this. Okay, ready? Here we go.
I called my student.
Here we go. Hold on. Yeah, I'm going to need some help. And go.
I called my students blogging about my course last night.
Did they say nice things?
No, and the links they shared weren't approved.
Then you need Zombie Board. All communication is under your control.
Sounds great. Please install it in every department.
Don't worry, we already have.
Zombie Board. Because learning is too serious to have fun.
So that's, you know, we have sponsors for the show, and one of those sponsors is Zombie Board. We'd like to thank our sponsors. Martin, you there?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. I'm sorry. I was running
there. Okay.
Must be a problem with my thing. So I went on and on about Fort Apache, the Bronx. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen that film, actually. And what was the John Carpenter film about the police station?
Oh yeah,
that's surrounded and over. Because that was of a similar vein. I think what that stuff portrays to me is that when you go into the city, they used to have is that people be able to tell immediately you're from the outside. Like you've got a big kind of siren on top of your car. It's like interloper, stranger, kind of come around this car. this person's not welcome here.
I mean, that one's a really good example, and that one you're thinking about with John Carpenter is Assault on Precinct 13.
That's it, Assault on Precinct 13, which is remade disastrously.
Yeah, terribly, with Ethan Hawke of all people. Now, now, think about this. Assault on Precinct 13, if you look at it, it's a 1976, 77 film. Maybe 78, but I don't think so. I think it was before Halloween, frankly, so I think it's 76 or 77. Well, if you think about that film and you think about what's happening, they have this multicultural gang, right? They have the Latino guy who's wearing like a Che Guevara shirt. You have this kind of crazy white guy who's actually the dude who's again in Escape from New York, who's the one when the president, they're looking for the president, and he looks at them and he goes, like that weird, he's got that crazy hair. He's one of the dudes, and then there's a black dude, and then there's another guy. And it's this weird multicultural gang that goes around, and they basically are doing what? Drive-by shootings, which is like 12 or 13 years before the whole, you know, what is the one, the famous one John Singleton did that made drive-by shooting kind of like, what is it called? Gangs? No.
Right. Was it, no, not with, yes, I know the one.
I don't know what anyway, I forget
the name. The LA film. Yeah.
That's right. And it's kind of what made, it's kind of what made... you know, the whole gangbanging of L.A. and that. But, you know, John Carpenter was kind of on that aesthetic and that idea, you know, close to 13, 14 years earlier. And then talk about John Carpenter, who's one of my favorites, and bring him back to New York. What about Escape from New York, where the whole idea is that, you know, New York has become a maximum security prison.
And again, that kind of place, that whole thing about, you know, cities become such fearful places that we practically, you know, in his film, literally sealed it off. But it's almost like we did that metaphorically. It's like we shouldn't go into these places anymore. We'll all move out to the suburbs. And the kind of big dream was to move to the country. Yeah. And I think we've seen a kind of reaction against that recently, and the kind of revitalization of city centres. We've seen people kind of moving back in and them being kind of desirable places to live again.
Well, it's interesting when you say that, because Chud, and I see that Noise Professor is a fan of Chud, me too. I wrote a whole paper on Chud once, which was pretty fun. But the thing about Chud, if you look at it, you go look at like the beginning opening scene of Chud, and this goes to your point, Martin, about like the kind of revolution from, you know, thinking of the city as this horrific space to thinking of it as this, you know, let's return to the city, this kind of return home. Well, in the beginning of Chud, you have this street sweeper, which is basically going through the street and cleaning up everything in its path. And it picks up the woman's shoe who had been killed the night before by this kind of rogue Chud.
Yeah.
And what's really interesting about it is that this idea, this metaphor of cleaning up the city, cleaning up the streets, I think runs through, whether consciously or not, so many of these films. Like the idea of the reaction against the city, the idea of this horrific notion of the city, is in many ways an attempt to scare the hell out of you in the suburbs and to keep you out of there, drive the prices down, and then allow for this kind of 1990s, 2000 gentrification. I mean, it's this whole new idea of the Wild West, of kind of going and kind of stakeholding in like the Lower East Side after the whole punk thing. You had these kind of ideas of squatters there, but then you had the idea of the art community moving in, and then you watch rents and mortgages go through the roof throughout the 90s into 2000 till we know where that all went. But I wonder if we can think of it as a continuum, you know, of the gentrification actually as a process and part and parcel of the horrific idea of the city.
So it's Travis Bickle's speech that kind of made real, like, someday a real rain will come and wash all the scum off the streets. It's like it's going to happen through kind of property prices in a way or something. So.
Yeah, I mean, and it's funny to me, and I have this theory, and I don't know, people have shot me down on it, but I think, like, you can see a lot of that stuff. Like, you can watch and trace a lot of those cultural, what we're talking about is, like, in hindsight, sure, it makes sense. But I think in the actual films of the time, you can actually see those kind of discourses emerging, right? Like, you can see them in The Warriors. You see this idea of Cyrus. I mean, I love the whole discourse of him saying, you know, we could take the streets. You know, can you count, suckers? Like, we could do this. I just love it.
That's right, anything. But that's not going to happen out in the Hamptons. So we're just going to live out there. Because
exactly.
There aren't 60,000... gangs in the Hamptons, so that'll be fine. So we saw this mass kind of move out, and it's strange. Where I grew up was kind of a new town. Wasn't really a new town. It was, they'd built three big kind of council estates in a place called Waltham Abbey, and it was just a kind of London overspill. And I think that London had this kind of, everyone lived in London, this big dream, let's move out to the country. So they kind of moved to just outside. But of course, then you do is just kind of create a kind of mini London, really. And so, and then everyone wants to go return to London, I think, after a while. So it's a strange time, I think. You know, and I think now the portrayals you get of the city are kind of desirable places to be.
Yeah. And you know who does a lot of interesting work? I mean, if you start thinking about geographies and this moving back and forth, it's there's two geographers, actually. David Harvey, who's a famous Marxist geographer, and the other gentleman whose name, for some reason, I'm forgetting. I actually work with him in grad center, in the grad center at CUNY. But anyway, this whole idea of the revanchist city, right, of kind of using the rhetoric of reclaiming the city as a highly reactionary idea. And I'm fascinated by that. And I was just seeing Noise Professor reminded me the movie in South Central that really has great parallels with Carpenter is actually called Boys in the Hood.
That's it. Right? Okay, yeah.
And Boys in the Hood, if you've ever seen the director's commentary, one of the cool things about it is he talks about using and stealing. Singleton talks about using and stealing from Sam Peckinpah and the whole The Wild Bunch and those slow-mo drive-by shootings. You know what I mean?
But you can see that in Assault on Precinct 13, it's really kind of just one of those westerns remade, isn't it? It's kind of, instead of the Indians kind of surrounding the wagons, you know, it's the kind of gangs surrounding the police station. So yeah, exactly, you kind of see that kind of the western mythology being brought into the city.
Yeah, and it's amazing because then you kind of re-identify, you know, what you're doing to kind of reclaim the city as kind of like a pioneer. Right? Like you're kind of on the, you know, and that's where you get the idea of capital and pioneer, right? Pioneering capital, going into these places, revamping them. And, you know, not that I think, obviously, I have my own opinions about all that, but it's interesting how so much of that plays out in these cultural artifacts and how much you can watch and how they go back to this mythical idea of the West.
Right. There are a lot of films. What was the film about an alligator that gets flushed down the New York subsystem and kind of grows massive and comes back and attacks? There's a lot of those kind of films, you know, there's something beneath you, there's kind of something growing beneath you, it's kind of, whether it's a subculture or some kind of mythical animal or something, but they're all kind of playing to that same kind of fear, isn't it, that you're not in control of this well-ordered city and life that you see around you.
And that's it. It's pretty funny because that was called, I think, Alligator. And
it just called Alligator.
I think And you know what, who wrote for that, like who was the screenwriter on that? John Sayles.
Oh, right. Okay.
So John Sayles, that was one of his early, that and Piranha were two of his early screenplays to get him going.
Yeah.
I love that. All right. Okay. So what I'm going to do is we're going to take a commercial break here quickly, and we're going to listen to some more. We got to feed our sponsors, right, Martin?
That's right. They've been very kind to us. And by the way, the music in the background, do you know what the music in the background is from these ads?
I loved it, but I didn't recognize it. No.
It's The Fog. John Carpenter's The Fog.
Now, we have to talk about that because I haven't seen The Fog probably since it came out in 79 or 80.
Okay.
That's the last time I've seen it. Have you seen that recently?
Oh, probably been about 10 years, but I've seen it more recently, yeah.
And did you love it?
It's I don't think it's one of my favorite. Right? Obviously, The Thing is my favorite Carpenter film.
Absolutely,
the Thing is probably my favorite film of everything. So
you know, we should have. Is that true? Because that means me and you are like practically related. We should have an entire show dedicated to The Thing.
That's right. They're remaking it, aren't they?
But isn't that a nightmare though?
I know. You don't want to go there, do you?
But. What do you think? I mean, we're going to go to our commercial break, but I think we have something to talk about as we return back. Because a lot of our favorite films over the last, you know, about 8-9 years have been remade. Not all of them, but a lot. And let's talk a little bit about remake culture and some of that stuff, because they're certainly not remixing anything very interesting, right?
No.
I mean, that's absolutely, anyway, after our commercial break. Okay, and here's a note from our sponsors, Zombie Board.
Are you tired of having new technology thrust in your face like an overripe banana?
You bet I am.
Fed up of having some hip young lecturer talk about his aggregated, distributed, open, multimedia, popular course?
I sure am.
Then make sure you make use of Zombie Board compulsory.
Zombie Board. We've sucked all the innovation out so you don't have to.
Zombie Board, I'm telling you, they never fail to amaze me. I mean, they really have it all covered, right? I mean,
they got it all done for you. You don't have to think.
It's good, and it's good that they're able to kind of take out any sense of innovation, so we know what's coming. You know, I like safe. A predictable. I like a predictable education, I have to say. So, okay. So, remakes. I mean, we've had everything from Nightmare on Elm Street to Halloween's been remade like 20 times.
Yeah.
But it's also like they're going to like the core of horror films, right? They're going to like Last House on the Left, the old gold stuff.
So I saw My Bloody Valentine recently, the remake of that, which was in 3D, and it was just, oh. And I think that the reason they remake them is because they were made fairly cheap for originally, and they kind of gained some kind of cult status. And I think we may as well remake it kind of properly and officially. But then they're too slick, and I think it's that understanding that a slight corniness about it is actually part of what works for it. You know, it's like, I think they remade Texas Chainsaw Massacre, didn't they?
Yeah.
And the Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a funny one, because I loved it, and it was banned over here. And it's one of those, we can talk about video nasties later, it's one of those video nasties that you couldn't get hold of, and you should manage to get a pirate copy. And I remember I was sharing a house with students who were about, when I was doing my PhD, they were about sort of 8 years younger than me, and they hadn't seen it. And I showed it to them, and they laughed, because they couldn't get that it was, they were so used to kind of seeing such commercial and slick horror films that they couldn't take it seriously, because it was kind of so 70s. But I think the kind of restraints he had on him, Tobe Hooper, when he was making that film, kind of really makes a very kind of claustrophobic film. And you don't actually see an awful lot, do you? It's like all the great films. So his constraints are what made it scary. But when they had the kind of a full budget, it's just like another slasher film. We've kind of seen this so many times. So I think that's what I think the big remakes don't understand, is that the kind of constraints are what make it good. And I'm going to do one of my mapping back to technology and education links again. People have heard me give this talk about big open education resources and little open education resources. And I think with the little ones, you know, things like us doing this or doing a YouTube video as opposed to kind of big broadcast productions, the little ones have a kind of implicit message in their naffness, in their kind of lo-fi quality that says to people, you can do this as well. So it's an invitation to participate and to be part of it, whereas high production just says sit back and take this stuff. And I think people don't understand that kind of lo-fi has a certain message of itself.
Yeah, and it's one I still much, I really come back to, and I'm gravitating back to her. And it's actually a really good plug for what this whole DS-106 radio thing is. I mean, it's this crazy, you hear me stumbling around. I don't know what the hell I'm doing with radio or audio, but it's fun to actually be here and know that it is lo-fi, but actually sitting here and talking with you as an event and occasion, you know, to get kind of meta on the whole thing is cool. Right, it's a cool thing to be doing, and my theory on the remakes, and I've watched a lot of them. I actually told Antonio Vantaggiato, who's in Sagrado in Puerto Rico, and who's actually been doing some great stuff for the radio station. Thank you, Antonio. But we were talking about this, and you know, I told him I'm going to watch them all, and I'm going to look at how this thing is going. Now, I didn't watch them all, but I watched a lot of them, and to me, I'm really cynical about it. I feel like almost every remake I've watched, and I've watched a bunch of them, Nightmare on Elm Street, the recent My Bloody Valentine, the other one, Prom Night, through and through and through. And Prom Night's a great film. We should talk about at some point. I think the beginning of that film is one of the most beautiful film. I really do. And it's a whole, this abandoned schoolhouse. There's a lot going on there. But I really think it's Hollywood cannibalizing itself, because it is in such a way, it has kind of refused to acknowledge what's happening to video, what's happening to film, what's happening to crowdsourcing, all the stuff. And they're just basically going back to a community like they do with toys or with anything, and they're just grabbing it. They're saying, you know, we'll put X amount of money because we know we're going to make X amount of money. We won't rethink anything. And anything we do rethink, we'll make worse. But we'll just capture, you know, I really feel like that's when I feel like the films that I love from my childhood and from those VHS 80s are being sold back to me so cheaply right now.
Yeah.
And it really disgusts me. You know what I mean? I mean, I really take some real kind of, like, it's like a visceral reaction.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, as Darcy said, the thing is a prequel, so it's not a remake. And so I've heard reasonable things about it, although I'm not sure. I've heard there may be a woman in it. I mean, goodness sake, a woman in the thing? That can't be right, surely. Yeah. But so I'm prepared to give that some credit. I think they're talking about sort of doing something different with it. And Noise Professor talks about The Hills Have Eyes, which was a great film, and that was amazing. Remade disastrously as well, wasn't it? Yeah. So it is a kind of it feels like trampling over your memories in a way, isn't it? It's like with no kind of thought about what they're doing with it. I mean, occasionally you do get someone who kind of remakes something out of love or kind of affection and stuff. So, you get a director remake their own film. So the Ring was kind of famously remade for America as well, it was pretty much kind of a copy of his original film.
And it wasn't bad. And there's a great, I mean, the way the thing deals with the VHS as horror is a really interesting, I mean, that would be a film to talk about too. We got shows lining up now.
That's right.
Now, the other thing I think, and I think not Noise Professor, but Dr. Garcia brought this up, and I'll reiterate it. One of my first, you'll like this, Dr. Garcia, one of my first date films that I ever went on a date, you know, with, that was in like eighth or ninth grade, and I can remember the girl's name. Her name is Kim George. We actually went to see Night of the Comet. And it's funny because by that time, I was 12 or 13, I had seen like Night of the Living Dead, Dawn of the Dead. I had seen some of the hardcore stuff because of VHS. Like my brother started pumping it in at about 9 or 8. So I was seeing this stuff pretty early. So you're right. When I did see that, I was like, what kind of zombie ass film is this? Like, you know, there's nothing to it. It's like the meteor creates zombies. Like I was already a critic of the zombie genre to some degree, you know, but I was also biased because that film holds a special place in my heart. Mainly, not only for the soundtrack, but because it was the first date film I ever went on. And the one I went after that was like Lassiter. And do you remember that film with Tom Selleck?
Yeah. Oh, that sounds painful.
Oh, it was terrible. Oh, and that's right. You're right. New Wave Zombies, Dr. Garcia. I have to go back and see that. You're right. But yeah, that was a fun film. I mean, it was a little bit... Who was in that? Okay, I'll go back and I'll do some research on that. Yeah.
I don't know if I've seen Night of the Comet. It's not worth seeing.
You know, it might be. I think Dr. Garcia has my interest piqued because she's right. In all capitals, she's writing on Twitter, New Wave Zombies. And that's probably right. I mean, you probably have. I mean, and I think about New Wave Zombies. We had talked about this before, but I'm getting into Big Love right now. I'm going on like three separate strains. I'm watching Big Love, which is an HBO series here in America. I'm watching Boardwalk Empire, which I really love.
Well, that's just started over here. Okay, so we're getting that over here now, yeah.
I think for me, that shows just what a great actor Steve Buscemi is. I mean, I didn't realize that till I started seeing that, and I was really impressed. And the other one, I'm finally watching Deadwood. So I got three strains going, which is kind of nice. But what I think is interesting, and what I think is, just to see if I can bring my point back, because I'm a little bit out with my mind. You see, Martin, it's like a little bit out there. I'm going to see if I can pull radio time out to bring it back.
Bring it back.
But I was thinking about it. The whole, I don't know where I was going to go. You're going to have to pick me up.
Okay. We might have to just pull the plug, but go for it, Jim. Run with it.
Well, I don't know where I was going with that. I mean, the idea, though, that I was trying to make that one day will come back to me is unclear. In fact, what I think has happened is it's gone into some kind of time-space continuum that I don't really understand, but I'm looking for the perfect film to get it out of. But one we were talking about is the remakes, and the remakes do truly annoy me. I mean, I think it's showing just how cannibalistic our culture is on itself. And I see that Noise Professor's talking about Deadwood might be the best. Now, Have you, Martin, seen The Wire?
I started watching it. I'm no good with, I haven't got stamina for TV series, you see. That's why I like films. I can get in, it's a 2-hour hit, and I get all I want from it, then I'm out again. A TV series that's on continually, I run out of steam. So yeah. I saw bits of it, you know. I saw the first, I think, series, I think, and that was it. So. Well, I loved it, but it was just I never had the stamina.
Well, TV was never, I mean, the HBO series weren't, but when I got hooked on Oz early, which was the whole prison one, and then Sopranos, that happened. But then I started to get into it, and I didn't watch it for a while. When I first came to Mary Washington, I didn't have time to do anything but work. And it's funny, about year three or four here, I finally picked up The Wire, and me and my wife watched it like pretty much a month straight. And I was blown away by it. And that's dealing with a lot of the issues we're talking about with the urban right now. And the reason I talk about The Wire is because The Wire is this really interesting kind of meditation in four or five different genres almost, like at first, or not even genres, institutions. It deals with the police force. It then goes on to deal with the docks. It then goes on to deal with City Hall. It goes on to deal with the public education. And then finally it ends with the media. And it actually is a look at Baltimore as a city through these five different lenses. And what's fascinating is it's looking at the city as this kind of focal point of, you know, what has happened to our notion of humanity and how have we disenfranchised the labor force here? How have we disenfranchised our own people? You know, how have systems and systems of thinking in many ways kind of brought us to this really, I think, you know, subhuman level of interaction and of community? And it's a really kind of hardcore meditation on that, but it's also not preachy at all. So it's just really, and it's like based on Greek myths. It's, I mean, I know you're not into the TV and you just spent 5 minutes explaining to me that you're not going to do it, but I was really, I mean, I understand that, but I was really blown away by The Wire. And I know this isn't The Wire, but it does bring us back to why we're here. And why we're here is to talk about 80s and film, right?
That's right.
Now, I got a little special. Yeah, go ahead.
I was going to say, one thing I'd like to talk about is the impact of the format. I think it's interesting. I think that the reason a lot of those films could manage to be kind of quite low key and still successful, things like Driller Killer and stuff, and I Spit on Your Grave, which weren't particularly great films, but they kind of got a good circulation because of the VHS format. And it's interesting what you have when you have a different outlet. There's a kind of a push back into the medium. And I was writing today about in the way that say blogs might have a similar impact. So, and I've been thinking about research. So I'm making another these tenuous connections here. But like, if you think of what the stuff that Tony Hearst does, in some ways, because a blog exists, Tony can do kind of small nuggets of research, things that take him an hour or two to play him with some data or something and mashing it up, and because he's got an outlet to do it. Whereas when he didn't have that outlet, he probably wouldn't have done that stuff. You know, you need to have a 2-year project and write it up as a conference paper or something. He wouldn't have done that. But the presence of the blog itself changes what we might perceive of as research. And I think you can see VHS kind of changed the way certain films could afford to exist. And I think we're seeing a type of that happening now online. We're seeing people using YouTube and stuff. So that's why that's where the innovation is. That's where the exciting stuff is. And I think the further that the kind of big media gets away from that, the kind of more detached it seems. That's why all these remakes seem kind of so far removed from the stuff we do that they never do anything interesting with them. They just kind of, and the same when they take games, they don't do anything interesting. They just kind of make them as straightforward. They just take the plot of the game and make it as a kind of straightforward film rather than kind of building in any of the kind of the game language and semantics, if you like, into it.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I think it actually builds on a point that I was talking to a guy, he's a filmmaker in Italy. He's a good friend. His name is Andrea Andriotti. And he knows a lot about American film and particularly the Hollywood, I mean, studios from like the 50s, 60s, and 70s. One of the things he was talking about, and it's a book I want to get now, he said, you know, David Mamet wrote about Hollywood and what he called the decline of Hollywood. And one of the reasons David Mamet, according to Andrea, who talked to me about the book, was saying that David Mamet argued that, you know, in the highlight of the Hollywood from maybe the 40s through the 70s, you had far more directors and artists than you did producers. And he said by the 80s and 90s, because of the advent of this new medium, not only did you have, like, you know, the distribution of producers, but as we're coming in now, we're starting to see that the producers, like at universities, maybe the administrators, are like 99% of the budget for all this stuff. And, like, you know, they throw a little bit money at the actors or whatever, a little bit money at the directors, but it's just this kind of conglomerate of people producing crap. And obviously they're not imaginative, so they go and they just kind of raid their own archives and they produce whatever just to make a buck. But, like, what you've done, and like you said, is you've kind of denatured the form from the art that has kind of created the form. You know, and the VHS, like you're arguing, I think brings up a whole bunch of questions. But it also brings up for me some hard things to deal with, because as you probably know and as you've experienced in the 80s when we started to see the VHS emerge, right? What we also started to see is those single film houses go away. and the kind of culture around film really changed dramatically.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, the appreciation of the aesthetic, of watching it as a 35 millimeter experience, of actually going to the cinema.
That's right. And there's an interesting kind of two things happened then. So the studios kind of took control of the outlet as well, which has kind of allowed them to say, we control the complete distribution chain, which didn't have to be the case, you know, but that's the way that business works now. And at the same time, they were really scared of VHS. And if you go back, you see lots of reports now about how they're trying to stamp out video and say it's going to be the death of cinema. And it took them until about sort of late 80s to realize that actually there was a really good business in this. And they could sell and rent videos, and the films had a second life then. So far from killing the cinema, it was extra money for them. And you see that the reverse of that argument now, they're talking about piracy and stuff, is like, you know, they're arguing that, in the Far East, you know, 90% of our DVD sales are pirates that we kind of lose now. So suddenly they're realizing that the home sale is the kind of major route for their profit and stuff. And so they're given the reverse of the argument that they used to give to in the 80s when they were kind of fearing it as an attack on their industry.
Yeah.
So kind of every new technology that comes along, they see as a threat to their current status quo rather than seeing kind of how can they utilize it.
Well, it's also, I mean, we haven't talked about it yet, but it might be cool. We have a few more minutes. Think about the idea of what the 80s introduces in terms of remix culture. Now, there is this kind of, Henry Jenkins was talking with this group, and I'm trying to think, I talked about them last semester. I mean, there is a group of women, particularly women, it wasn't kind of like anyone, who, you know, around the 80s and 90s had created this whole culture around culture jamming, around taking their famous, you know, their favorite star from Dallas or from, and doing these amazing, elaborate, what we would call mashups now, with, you know, VHS decks. Like, they'd be getting on the two decks, and they'd be recording, and they'd be creating this, you know, insane mashup. It's where we got the whole Apocalypse Poo. Have you ever seen Apocalypse Poo?
No, I don't think so.
I mean, I don't know. It's not the first mashup. I don't think it'd be fair to argue that. But Apocalypse Poo is basically like someone took clips from Winnie the Pooh, and they put the soundtrack from Apocalypse Now. And you have Winnie Pooh in front of the mirror, like in the beginning of Apocalypse Now, and he's going crazy. And you have Martin Sheen on the back end talking about, you know, how his wife is, you know, he's getting a divorce and how he's going crazy. It's just amazing. And that was it was a product of VHS culture. And I was a Canadian, actually, who did it. I forget his name, but it was actually a Canadian. So, boo-rah for all you Canadians.
Cool. Yeah, I think it's in the same way that kind of vinyl people have kind of a real affection for vinyl, and particularly the kind of album art cover in there. I kind of have an affection for VHS cases in particular. They're kind of big and chunky, and it felt like you were getting a weighty film. You know, it's like, and you could ponder over the cover itself. And we talked about this briefly before, and it was an interesting time because there were no kind of big chains of video stores. So you had to join. There's lots of kind of independent stores. It was kind of a new industry, and at the time I had to buy my first film and then you could rent it out after that, so I had to pay £40 to join a video club, which is a lot of top money back in like 81 or whatever.
Sure.
And then you could pay to kind of rent it, but they would have, because piracy was kind of a big thing, it was the first time we kind of really hit piracy, and you could go in and say, like, can I see what's under the counter, and they'd bring out this little shoebox sort of like all the pirated films. That's where you could get all the films that have been banned, like Evil Dead and stuff, you know.
So Evil Dead was banned.
Yeah, it was banned over here completely. So you couldn't see it legitimately, I don't think, until the 90s maybe. It was like, yeah, it was but of course we'd all seen it, so no more surefire ways to get a bunch of school kids to see a film than to ban it, you know.
Well, so you would go in there and you'd go to the mom and pop and you would see, now, could you see the art? Like, how would you see the artwork for those films? Like, were there other places to go and see it? Like magazines?
You might have seen some of that, but a lot of those films are just kind of like with a single white label on, they'd kind of been reproduced back at someone's, you know, back in someone's garage. And in fact, one of our favorite pirate video places was, in fact, a fire station. So the kind of part-time business these firemen was renting out pirate videos. I'm sure it's not allowed.
It's a good way to supplement your income, I'll tell you.
That's right. Yeah.
Now the other thing is, and I love what you're saying. I mean, I can think of this so clearly. We had this place called East Coast Video. It was on Baldwin, where I grew up, and you know, my family was notorious for not returning videos. So there was actually, we would get a video, like I remember one of the videos we had Amadeus. We literally had Amadeus out for like 2 years. And we had like, you know, they put it in this plastic blue case. Like, so you would see the thing, you would go around and, you know, the VHS things were all decorated on the shelves. And you'd go and you'd look through and there was nothing in it, maybe like a little piece of styrofoam to make it look solid. And then you would look at them and you'd kind of touch them. So it was also that tangible thing. And then you'd look at the back for the kind of screenshots that really told you about the movie. But, you know, we kept the Amadeus out, and I remember the blue case. But I remember going into East Coast Video one time and seeing the box for Silent Night, Deadly Night. And that box still, to my mind, is like one of the iconic boxes. It's got the hand of Santa Claus coming out of a chimney. And in it is an axe, and the axe is all bloody, and there's like snow all over the roof, and on a bit where the axe is there's a bit of blood falling off onto the snow. It's just amazing, amazing cover art. And you had actually recently talked about cover art that came from Japan. And so all these different cultural cover arts for these films, which I just love. I think it's a whole kind of material culture thing that came with the VHS culture that I was a fan of. Martin, you there, Martin?
Still there?
Yeah, I'm just having problems with my headphones. But I mean, the whole thing with the material culture was great.
Good. Okay, you can hear me still?
Yes.
Okay, fine. Yeah. No, I was thinking this about I think the film that's just called Zombie in the US was called Zombie Flesh Eaters over here. And I think, how can you, if your pulse doesn't race at a title like Zombie Flesh Eaters, you know, then you practically are undead. So that was another kind of the great films to be seen. And I think the other thing that kind of VHS did was, because it kind of democratized home viewing and video viewing and film viewing. So it you could see lots of stuff that you wouldn't see normally. We kind of had an informal film club. And I know Bar of a Tuesday is named after your kind of informal.
That's right. Absolutely. You there? I'm not sure I can hear you now. Let's see if we can hear you. Martin? I'm loving where you're going with this informal film club stuff, so I hope we get this. Martin. Okay. I'm not sure. Let me check on Twitter and see if other folks can hear you. They very well may. That's right, it allowed for the pause. And I guess you're here. Guys out there, Noise Professor, you seem to be sticking with us. I love the whole scanner thing. Can you hear Martin clearly? Because I'm having problems with my headphones. I'm not. But if you can, that would be great. And when a stranger calls. Yeah, that's a good one. And Martin's still there, so I don't know why my headphones are freaking out. But let me just try and do this. Martin, can you hear me? I'm sure you can. I guess I can't hear you. Okay. But he's typing now. He just checked out. Okay, good. So I can hear you good. And Martin, I think, actually, you know, despite all the small technical glitches, and Noise Professor, I'm sure, will school us on how to do this right, but I can't help but say this has been a lot of fun to do, to sit here and just chat about film. And I didn't know what actually, you know, official form it would take, but I really like, I agree. Big up to the Noise Professor as well with that. And Martin, they can't hear you, so this is just basically right me, but I'm going to end this show in a second and bring it back to regular radio. It's about time. It's 5:02 anyway. But let me just say that I had a lot of fun actually doing this and just kind of sitting here talking about film with Martin. And I know I had a lot of technical problems, so I'm not sure who's going to want to do it with me again. But I like this idea of just sitting here and, you know, focusing in on the 80s. I mean, just the stuff you're saying about what films were banned in England, which ones weren't, and also your insights about the actual how the studio system works. I have a book on my desk right now, which is about the 80s, and it's called A Pot of Gold. And it's all about the old VHS and what it meant. And it is intelligent for an audience. I don't know, but we'll see. I mean, they'll vote us off soon enough. It will be easy enough. We'll just have no listeners, right? Yeah, but and that's what's important about this right now, for us to have fun. So, and that's Martin talking to me through Skype, through chat. So I'm actually relaying that. He's saying, you know, it's indulgent for all of you, but it's fun for us. But, I mean, I really want to do this again. I want to make this a weekly show every 4 o'clock on Thursday. And talk about 80s films. And because there's a lot of things that I've been meaning to get at and meaning to discuss. And obviously, Martin's a smart dude and he knows the stuff. And we both have this passion about it. So I think this is going to be an ongoing show. It's going to be called Reagan Loves Thatcher, 1980s Movies. And I want to thank all of you who stayed on and listened. I know it was indulgent. Martin is right. But for us, it's fun. And I think part of DS106 Radio that makes it so cool is that people can come on here and do it. And you also, as listeners, have the choice to not listen anymore because it's overly indulgent. And that's also what's great about it, too. So that's it for Reagan Loves Thatcher, 1980s Movies. I'm going to put you back on DS106 Radio, but not before I say we love you, each and every one. Take care.